Finding Golda by Margot Singer. The dog was gone. Yehuda walked around the minivan, opening the doors, peering under the seats, as if the dog might rematerialize if he just looked one more time. He was an idiot to have left the window down. He was an idiot taking the dog with him in the first place. Golda, the stupid mutt, who thought every place she went belonged to her. But there was no one home to let the dog out, and Yehuda had to work. He kicked the van's rear door shut and shouted again, his breath puffing out in mist. The late afternoon sky hung gray as an old sock over East Jerusalem. It smelled like rain.
He circled the van, whistling for the dog. The gate in the razor wire fence surrounding the building site had been opened to allow his van to pass. The dog could have gone anywhere at all. He scanned the compound. The old Shepherd Hotel stood before him, flanked by cypresses. Once the Grand Mufti's villa, now nothing but an abandoned hulk, with stained stone walls and windows black as broken teeth. It still gave off the dismal air of the border police, who had occupied the place for 20 years. Soon, Yehuda hoped, there would be bulldozers turning over the stony soil, I-beams and girders swinging into place, new apartment units rising from the wreck, if they ever got the go-ahead to build. "Golda, boy," Yehuda shouted. "Come."
He hoped the dog had not strayed far. He was uncomfortable here in Sheikh Jarrah, in this troubled part of town. Just down the road, he knew, stood the makeshift tents belonging to the Palestinian families who'd been evicted from their homes by Israeli settlers, religious Jews. Things were quiet now, but on Friday the protesters would be back, the peaceniks, marching from Jewish West to Arab East Jerusalem, waving signs, beating drums, demonstrating solidarity with the Palestinians who'd been forced to live out on the street. "Thou shalt not steal," their placards read. Just last week, the protest had turned violent. He and Nina had watched it on the evening news, the throng of activists pressing into the courtyard of the stolen house, the black-hatted settlers watching from the roof, where an enormous candelabra had been raised, as if the house were the temple itself, and they the victorious Maccabees. The footage showed a girl with a snare drum swinging from her neck, being frog-marched into custody, border guards in bulletproof vests punching and shoving a wild-haired young man against a van, kids, the lot of them, no older than Yehuda's own. There was a roar of chanted slogans, yells and screams. "For God's sake," Nina said, shaking her head at the TV.
Yehuda picked up the remote and switched the channel, pausing on one of those American shows consisting of happy teenagers dancing to bouncy pop. He wondered whether that was what life was like for their son, Itai, at his university in the States.
"Don't change the channel," Nina said. "That's your mess. Take a good look."
"Don't start."
"It's their neighborhood. Why can't you leave it be?"
Never mind that he was just a builder, hired to renovate an abandoned old hotel. Never mind that he wasn't the one forcing Palestinians from their homes. Nina was a taker in of strays and injured animals, a yoga nut, an American, a vegetarian, a bleeding heart. Now, after 30 years in Israel, with Itai off at university and their daughter Maya nearly finished with the army, Nina wanted to move back to L.A.
"It's a better life there."
"Sure, it's wonderful. There are wonderful earthquakes and race riots and forest fires and mudslides and smog and..."
At that, Nina unfolded her legs and stomped into Maya's old room and slammed the door and didn't speak to him all the next day. And when he woke up on Sunday morning, she was gone. There was just a note on the kitchen counter saying she'd gone off to a yoga retreat in Tel Aviv, reminding him to feed the dog. He left a string of messages on her mobile phone, but she didn't respond. He heated frozen dinners in the microwave and stayed up late watching TV. Without Nina, the house felt cold and unfamiliar, as if he were living in someone else's home.
Now he pulled his collar up against the damp December wind and pushed his hands into the pockets of his jeans. Somewhere, a dog was barking. The sound seemed to echo from all directions at once.
"Golda! Boy Hina, come here."
He quickened his pace, scanning the slope of the Vadi, once the Mufti's vineyard, now an open stretch of scrubby grass and dead wildflower clumps. Had the dog strayed there, beyond the rose walls of the old city? He was used to seeing it from the other side, from here, in East Jerusalem. It no longer looked like the place he'd known his entire life.
He would not be able to face Nina if he lost the dog. Nina had brought Golda home when Itai went to the army, a yellow shepherd retriever mix rescued from the pound, a charm for luck. Never mind that she peed on the oriental carpets, tracked mud onto the couch, cowered in the bathtub during thunderstorms, ate garbage whenever anyone left the lid off the bin. Never mind that she trampled the neighbors' flower beds, refused to heal. Now it was impossible to imagine life without her, her wet nose nuzzling him in the morning, her soft bulk curled up at his feet at night.
At the Nablus Road, he turned and headed toward the old city, whistling, scanning every alleyway and dumpster, every place a dog might hide. The sidewalks were more crowded here, workers hurrying home before the rain, women with sacks of groceries looped over the handles of their babies' prams. Now and then he stopped one of them, holding up his hand as if he were a cop.
Slachli, excuse me, may you be you have seen a yellow dog?
But no one had.
He pulled out his phone and scrolled through his messages as he walked, the screen a blue flare in the fading light. 4 messages from his boss, which he skipped, nothing from Nina. He texted her again. Please, he typed, I need you. Then he backspaced over the last 3 words and typed, come home, instead. The crowd at the Damascus Gate drew him forward as it funneled into the narrow passageways of the old city. It didn't really seem possible the dog would have come this far, but he found that he could no longer stop, as if the dog itself were leading him forward by an invisible thread. He stumbled through the labyrinth of alleyways hung with dingy goods and domed with arches, breathing the sweet smells of sweat and smoke and spice. He remembered coming here to the Muslim quarter for the first time as a child, after 67, his father hurrying him along, feeling on him the eyes of the men in kafiyas who gathered in the coffee houses around water pipes and games of backgammon, sheshbesh. He remembered the calloused roughness of his father's hand, the sureness of its grip.
Yehuda's back ached, his legs ached, his temples hurt. Darkness was falling and the temperature was dropping and he was old, older now than his father had been when he died. Just that morning, he'd stood at the kitchen window and watched the sun light the rooftops of West Jerusalem as it rose above the desert hills. Now it seemed as if that cold disk of a sun belonged to a different universe, distant, extinct. For 4 generations, his family had lived here in Jerusalem, since the days of the Muftis and the Turks. And for 51 years, he had lived here too, building a family, building houses, stone by stone. How had it come to this? He lowered his head against the wind and walked. The dog was lost, and he was lost as well, lost and alone and old. And then he turned the corner and stepped out of the darkness into a courtyard filled with flickering light. He was in the Jewish quarter now. Glass aquarium boxes, sheltering rows of oil lamps or candles from the winter wind, were mounted on the walls or set on chairs by the doorways to each house. The Jerusalem stone glowed golden in the candlelight. It was Hanukkah, of course. 8 candles, the 7th night.
Yehuda hadn't celebrated Hanukkah in years. Nina had made a big deal about the holiday when the children were small, frying up batches of greasy potato latkes in oil that stunk up the house for days, preparing presents, American style, for every night. He could see her guiding the children's hands as they touched the shamash to each wick, the wax dripping into clumps. Once, he recalled, they'd lit all the Hanukkah menorahs they'd collected over the years, 6 of them or more, rows and rows of candles, a conflagration, a thrill of flame and light. But this year, in the hollow quiet of the empty house, he'd almost forgotten that it was Hanukkah at all.
Now it seemed that each street that he turned down revealed the glimmer of glass-boxed Hanukkiot, like a string of beacons, a promise, or a guide. He walked faster, heading out of the old city into the familiar streets of West Jerusalem, blowing on his fingers to warm his hands. He was thinking of the Palestinian families huddled in their cold tents back in Sheikh Jarrah, of the ancient Israelites wandering in the Sinai wilderness, of Maya on her base in Ashkelon, Itai in New York, Nina wherever she was. They were all nomads now, displaced. And then, almost without realizing it, he was home. There was the terraced facade draped with bougainvillea, the blue-shuttered windows, familiar as a face. He'd come home to this house with Nina on the day they got married. He'd carried each child across this threshold on the day after they were born. And he was standing on the doorstep, fumbling for his keys, when the sound reached him. So familiar it didn't even register at first. The scrabbling of claws on tile, the thump against the door, the throaty bark. His heart bent like a flame. He stepped back, looked up. A light was on upstairs. His hands were trembling, whether from the cold or exhaustion or sheer relief, he could not tell. He considered them in the dim glow of the street lamp, ridged with veins, thick-fingered, worn and creased. Inside, Golda was barking, and soon he knew the door would open, and he would step inside, out of the darkness, and take Nina's hands once more in his.